We divided Revelation into seven sections, and we're treating them in six sermons, which means that tonight two of them are being put together. In the first section, we found seven letters to seven congregations in Asia Minor, what we know as Turkey today, the western edge of it. And John was out on the Isle of Patmos, a little island 6 miles wide, 10 miles long, barren, treeless, rocky, famous for nothing but its prisoner. And he sends this messenger to carry the letter in a semicircle all the way around to the seven congregations in Asia. Each of these congregations had some strength. At least five of them did. A couple of them are not really commended. Most of them had some weaknesses. But out of them emerges a kind of picture of characteristics God wants in His church. In chapters 4 through 7, we had a book in heaven. God was introduced, then Christ. And there was a book that nobody was worthy to open, and John wept until the Lamb was worthy. And as he opened its seven seals, the first four seals resulted in something terrible happening on earth, and it would affect the fourth part of the waters, for example, when the punishment would be poured out into that body of water. It looks like we come to the final judgment before we get to the seventh of the seals. But suddenly we come back and start the cycle over again, because when the seventh seal is opened, seven angels stepped out with seven trumpets. Six of those sounded, divided into four, two, and one again. The four, generally speaking, on the earth, the fifth and sixth on human beings, and then an interlude, and the seventh angel sounded his trumpet. That takes chapters 8 through 11. In chapters 12 through 14, we left sevens altogether. We saw a woman about to give birth to a child, and a dragon who is identified as the devil was crouched before her just waiting for her to give birth so he could devour the child. But the child was caught up into heaven and he wasn't able to destroy him. But he was assisted by a beast that came forth from the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, who was in turn assisted by a beast that came up from the land, having 2 horns like a lamb. And we tried to identify these, or I did identify them from my own judgment, as Satan, the dragon, the Roman Empire itself, the political power, the beast that comes up from the sea with the 7 heads, wisdom, the 10 horns, power, and the religious power united with the Roman Empire to force people to worship the emperor, shown under the figure of a second beast of the land with his horns like a lamb. There's several things about him that look like a religious power, but just to recapitulate, this is the way we left them last week. When he couldn't destroy the child who was caught up into heaven, whom we identified as Christ, then he tried to get the woman herself, the people of God, or the offspring of the woman, other Christians, those who keep the commandments of Jesus. And they are identified. Tonight we return the reading you heard to the prelude for 7 more portents to be poured out, or 7 more signs to be done. A series called this time 7 vials, if you're reading the King James Version, 7 bowls, if you're reading almost any other translation. The 15th chapter is an interlude. Usually we've been having this interlude after the 6th seal has been opened, or after the 6th trumpet has been sounded. But with the 7 bowls, we have the interlude, the consolation to the Christian. You don't need to be afraid. The judgment is just, and God is not going to punish you before we have any of the 7 bowls poured out. The 15th chapter is that interlude. It's the consolation of the Christian. The 16th chapter rather quickly pours out the bowls. Chapters 17 and 18 turn to a different cycle, but again, picture the opposing power as a great city, and that city falls in a day's time. I think it isn't too complex a section, with perhaps the exception of some verses in chapter 17, in view of what we've already gone through in the past. When John saw this portent in heaven, 7 angels with 7 plagues. He said they're the last, for with them the wrath of God is ended. With the seals, a fourth part would be destroyed in the water or on the land. With the trumpets, a third part. The destruction was heavier. But a trumpet was a call, a summons, a warning of judgment. The bowls are pictured as judgments themselves, and they're final and they're complete, and the judgment of God is ended here. With a series of 3 sevens, seals, trumpets, bowls. They are 3 parallel pictures of God's pouring out his wrath on those who persecute his people. But this is the final one in the sequence. that we're not going in a chronological fashion, I think is as obvious here as anywhere in Revelation. When chapter 14 ended last Sunday night, you remember that one came with a sickle, and he thrust that sickle in, and the earth was ripe for the harvest. And there was a wine press, and the wrath of God was trod upon in the wine press. And as they were treading the wrath of God, the whole vintage of the earth in righteousness, or the fruit, the produce, the evil work of the wicked is born. And the indications are we're at the end of the world. Then all of a sudden we go through the whole weary process again. Seven bowls, as if the whole of human history is laid out for us all over, and we hadn't just gone to the judgment at the end of chapter 14. Then John sees a sea of glass mingled with fire in heaven. It looks very much like that sea of glass we saw in chapter 4, except it's mingled with fire. I don't know why. Some of the suggestions have been that the trials are shown in the mingled color of the glass here. Or God's judgment begins to appear. He's now seen all the wickedness that's been done upon his people, or against his people. And this is the fire of his judgment. Whether it's the wrath of the persecutor or the wrath of God, I should rather think it's the wrath of God. A sea of glass mingled with fire is there. And those who've overcome the beast, those who didn't have his mark in the forehead, that 666 we talked about last week in closing, are standing by that sea of glass. In fact, some translations render it upon, because the Greek preposition is upon. And they're singing the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb. In the Old Testament, when Israel had been delivered across the Red Sea from Pharaoh's army, there was a song of deliverance sung. And the Israelites would sing a song of deliverance at the evening sacrifice, remembering how God had delivered them, saved them from their oppressors. And here we are given the words of a song to report out to God, which have already been read. After this, John looks and he sees a tent, a tabernacle in heaven. This isn't the first time. In the last verse of chapter 11, John saw God's temple in heaven open, and the Ark of the Covenant was seen in the temple. There were lightnings and thunders. But this time he doesn't see the Ark. Instead, out of the temple came seven angels with seven plagues, robed in pure bright linen, and their breasts girded with golden girdles. They look almost like priests would have looked in the Old Testament, so far as their clothing is concerned. And they're going out as messengers of God to bear his wrath. One of the four living creatures gave the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. Back in chapter 4, there were four living creatures. Each of them had a different face: the face of man, the face of fowl, the face of tame animals, the face of untamed animals, indicating the whole creation around the throne of God with the 24 elders, 12 patriarchs, 12 apostles, we suggested. And I think the significance here is that one of the four living creatures gives the bowls to the angels. The whole creation says, this is the right thing to do. These judgments are just. Those who have persecuted God's people deserve to be punished. The temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. No one could enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were ended. We may be reading too much into the symbolism, but the indications are that no prayer can change God's mind at this point. Nobody can walk into God's presence and change his mind. His wrath is going to be poured out in those seven bowls. Then John heard a loud voice from the temple telling those seven angels, go and pour out on the earth the seven bowls of the wrath of God. If you remember something about the trumpets a couple of weeks ago, you know that the first trumpet sounded and the punishment was poured out on the earth. The second, and it was poured out on the sea. The third, and it was poured out on rivers, fresh water. And the fourth, and it was poured out on the sun. That same sequence is followed here in the first four of the bowls. The first angel went and poured his bowl on the earth, and foul and evil sores came upon the men who bore the mark of the beast and worshipped his image. I think the greatest point here is a reminiscence of the sixth plague in Egypt, when boils came upon every man in Egypt as a punishment from God because of what the Egyptians were doing to the Israelites as slaves. Now sores come upon men as the bowl is poured out on the earth. The second angel poured his bowl into the sea. It became like the blood of a dead man, and every living thing died that was in the sea, which will remind you of how waters were turned to blood in Egypt as well in the plagues. Third angel poured his bowl into the rivers and the fountains of water, and they became blood. And I heard the angel of water say, the water becomes blood, and the angel who is charged with the keeping of the waters says, just art thou in these thy judgments, thou who art and wast, O Holy One. For men have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink. It is their due. And I heard the altar cry, a kind of antiphonal singing. Yea, Lord God the Almighty, true and just are thy judgments. Even the angel of the water which receives the judgment says, it's just. And the altar cries out antiphonally, yes, it is just. The fourth angel poured his bowl on the sun, and the sun, which is ordinarily a source of blessing, becomes a source of cursing because it began to scorch the men. And instead of their repenting, they began to curse and blaspheme God. And again, we're given an insight into the depth of the wickedness God is opposing with these punishments. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was in darkness. Men gnawed their tongues in anguish and cursed the God of heaven for their pain and sores and did not repent of their deeds. The earth, the sea, the rivers, the sun have all been punished, indicating that the fullness, the completeness of God's punishment of those who've opposed his people. Now the very throne of the beast himself is punished, and there's darkness all over his kingdom. There are men, women, and children all over the world tonight who know what it means to gnaw their tongues with pain, but that's what's done when the fifth bowl is poured out. The sixth bowl gets us into something a little more unusual. The river Euphrates is dried up by this one. The sixth angel poured his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw issuing from the mouth of the dragon, and from the mouth of the beast, and from the mouth of the false prophet, our three enemies back in chapters 12 to 14, the dragon, the devil, the beast of the sea, the false prophet, that religious beast of the land, three foul spirits like frogs. They were demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Lo, I'm coming like a thief. Blessed is he who is awake, keeping his garments, that he may not go naked and be seen exposed. And they assemble them at the place which is called in Hebrew Armageddon. Here I think we should tarry for a moment because of the unusual interpretations that have been given. I've talked about the futurist school, the late great planet Earth school, the dispensationalist or premillennial school, and what it sees in these various signs. I've talked about the continuous historical school that sees Revelation as outlining history from 100 AD to the end of the world. The continuous historical school has usually seen the apostasies of Romanism through the centuries away from true New Testament Christianity depicted in the various signs. And some have gone so far as to suggest that the three foul spirits like frogs are the Council of Trent, Vatican Council, and the doctrines about Mary. That would be going much further than I would be willing to go in trying to identify these frogs with any given events. On the other hand, the futurist, a man like Lindsay, says in his late great planet Earth and in his study of Revelation, the great world coming, that what is going to happen here is that we're going to have a series of battles. When the seven-year tribulation starts on Earth with the seven-year rapture of the saints in heaven, the Antichrist, who will be the Roman dictator, who's head of the revived Roman Empire, you just have to believe me as I go along. I don't know how all of this can be drawn together either, except that passages are taken out of Daniel and Ezekiel and other Old Testament prophets long since fulfilled and applied to a time out at the end of the world linked with Revelation. But the Roman dictator, who's head of the revived Roman Empire, who is the Antichrist, makes a covenant with the Jews, lets them rebuild their temple and worship in it freely, if they'll just give him allegiance. And for 3.5 years it goes along well until he marvels the whole world or astounds the whole world with his ability to keep peace. And finally he decides he'll go down to Jerusalem, walk into the temple, the Holy of Holies, and pronounce himself to be God. And they link 2 Thessalonians 2 with that. And so he does pronounce himself to be God. When he does, the Jews have to flee. And as I mentioned last week, the suggestion is even made that perhaps the American fleet in the Mediterranean will take the Jews down to Petra, the city of rock, where they can hide away from this terrible punishment. Meanwhile, the king of the south, Daniel 11:40, having nothing to do with Revelation 16, I'm convinced, but Daniel 11:40 mentions a king of the south. And that's taken to mean that the Arab and African powers get together and they decide that they're going to invade Palestine. They do, and overcome it, and set up headquarters on Mount Zion. About that time, the king of the north, also Daniel 11:41-42, Russia, it's identified as in this scheme, decides to come down and take over mineral-rich Israel. Her minerals are not too obvious right now in their richness, but the minerals or the richness seems to lie around her at present. But anyway, the king of the north comes down and there's a battle, and Russia overcomes the Arab African nations. At this point, when Russia has gone down into Egypt to solidify her conquest of the Arab African nations, the Roman dictator, the revived Roman Empire ruler called the Antichrist, doesn't like the breach of world peace, so he comes down and defeats the Russians. The United States, not directly mentioned in the prophecy, is supposed to be an ally with the common market countries who are behind the Roman dictator, the revived Roman Empire, the Antichrist. So there are just two powers left in the world, these Western powers under the Antichrist, the Roman dictator, and the Chinese. And so the River Euphrates is dried up, and 200 million Chinese soldiers come across, and a battle is fought at Megiddo, the hill of Megiddo. And it would end everything. The world would end. Everybody would be annihilated were it not for the second coming of Christ and the millennial reign begins. Now that, to me, is a real strain all the way through of one's ability to believe that this is what's being said in the passage. It could give no possible comfort to a Christian in Asia Minor in AD 96 to know that something like this is going to happen out at the end of the world. It's a real strain of the prophecies from Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 11, as well as from Revelation 16. A much, much easier interpretation would be simply that there's an 1,800-mile river named Euphrates over that flows into the Persian Gulf, and from the earliest days of the Abrahamic conquest and the conquest of Israel by his descendants, that had been the border that protected them from their enemies. When the Roman Empire was set up, she never did conquer the Parthians, the Persians, and with their cavalry, they lay on the other side of that river Euphrates. And if God wants to destroy Rome, he not only has, as we saw in an earlier night, internal decay, moral rottenness in Rome, droughts, plagues, natural calamity, he also has foreign invaders. You name the country that goes against God's will, that sets itself up in the place of God, and God always has a nation waiting to crush that country. History unfolds it again and again. And it's a much easier interpretation to believe that the Parthians are going to be allowed to come across with their cavalry and take a part in destroying this Roman Empire which is persecuting the Christians. And with that suggestion as to a possible interpretation, I would leave it. There's no indication of it being anything like a battle between 200 million Orientals and all the Western powers under a revived Roman emperor. Megiddo was the place where Gideon defeated the Midianites. It was the place where Saul died in his battle with the Philistines. It was the place where Barak and Deborah defeated the Canaanites. And it was the place where Pharaoh Necho killed Josiah, the boy king who tried to lead Israel out of her apostasy just before the Babylonian captivity. In other words, the low hills around Megiddo, the plain of Esdraelon that stretches out from it, have probably seen as much bloodshed as any similar-sized patch of land on the globe. It was Waterloo. It was a classic battlefield, Gettysburg. You just think of a battle when you think of Megiddo, and that's the significance of the imagery. God is going to bring Rome to her knees, and he'll do it in part by allowing her enemies to come against her. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. And so as he pours out his bowl, the great city is split into three parts, and cities of the nations fell, and God remembered great Babylon to make her drink or drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. Great hailstones that seem to weigh 100 pounds fall on people as the seventh angel pours out his bowl, and we seem to have come to the end again. Seven bowls, like the seven seals and the seven trumpets, except more final, more complete. Not a destruction of a fourth or a third, not a warning of something that's coming ahead, but the destruction is here. In the trumpets and the seals, men were not bothered till the fifth in each of the series. But in the bowls, men are bothered with the first, with sores all over their bodies. So the punishment is more complete. It's more terrible. Chapters 17 and 18 give us a parallel story, but we switch away from the sevens to the picture of a city. In chapter 17, we're introduced to a woman who is a harlot. Come, I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot, who's seated upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers on earth have become drunk. He carried me away in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of blasphemous names, and had 7 heads and 10 horns. We're back to our Roman Empire again, and a woman is seated on her, which I would take to be pagan Rome, the religious power of Rome, riding again, religion riding the political, going against the people of God. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, bedecked with gold and jewels and pearls, a cup in her hand with the filth of her sinfulness in it, and she has a name on her forehead, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. She is the enemy. Now, to go back to the futurist interpretation, the dispensationalists are saying that the ancient city of Babylon will be rebuilt. that probably some of the Arab oil money that's pouring in now and that they need something to do with will be poured into rebuilding the city of Babylon, sort of like Brasilia was built in a 10-year period out in the middle of nowhere, a new city. Well, I don't think it will prove that their interpretation is right if the Arabs decide to build a city named Babylon, but it does seem, again, a rather strained interpretation. In Lindsay's case, he comes right back and says, but I don't believe this prophecy as a whole is about Babylon. I believe it's about Rome. It would be easier then for us just to stay with Rome. The beast that you saw was and is not and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel. Behold this beast, because it was and is not and is to come. Things get a little harder here. A beast who was, is not, and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. That's why we connect it with Rome, a seven-hill city, the persecutor of the people of God. There are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must remain only for a little while. Various interpretations, again, are available. One is that there were seven kings who helped to establish Rome as a great empire. I like another interpretation better, and it suggests, as I did last week, that Nero, the first persecutor of Christians from the Roman kings, now dead, has been revived in spirit in the person of Domitian, who sits on the throne. So that the beast was, he is not, and he is to come. There is an on and offness in the persecution. There are five kings that have already gone. Now we have another king, Domitian. There will be more persecution to come in the future. It isn't all over with Domitian. And yet God is going to overcome. I'm a lot less sure of that than I am that the whole vision, as an entirety, refers to the city of Rome and her power against the Christians. The seven-hill city and the ten horns with power going out in wrath against the church. One doesn't have to be absolutely sure he's identified every tree in order to get a picture of what the forest is about. And the forest is about that persecution these people are undergoing. And it's God's promise that it will be overcome. A little later, there are ten kings that are represented by these ten horns, and they're given power, authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. They have one mind, they give their power and authority to the beast, and they make war on the Lamb. It's obvious what they're doing. They're persecuting the church, the Lamb's people. They appear to be vassal kings, kings of the provinces, who have only one thing in mind, help Domitian. Enforce what he's doing. Help the head of the empire, because what's good for him is good for us. And so they oppose the Lamb. The last paragraph of the 17th chapter says, he said to me, the waters you saw where the harlot is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. The ten horns you saw, they and the beast will hate the harlot. They'll make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and giving over their royal power to the beast till the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman you saw is the great city which has dominion over the kings of the earth. Whenever you have a case of church and state uniting, corruption is going to ensue. And ordinarily, the one is going to turn against the other. And my judgment is that we've the same thing being pictured here. That pagan Rome, with all of her abominations, finally crowned in the worship of the emperor himself, riding on the back of the empire for power and carrying out her persecution against the Christians, now finds herself set at odds even within the empire. The religious forces and the political forces begin to turn against one another as a part of the destruction that comes. Finally, in chapter 18, the great city Babylon falls. In the first six verses, it's announced. And if you've ever read it, you scarcely need it read again. Because fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul spirit. And most of this language could be repeated from the Old Testament's language about the ancient city of Babylon itself. Most of it is directly brought over from the Old Testament. It's a haunt of every foul and hateful bird, for all nations have drunk the wine of her impure passion. Kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich with the wealth of her wantonness. Again, part of our problem is that we're not familiar enough with the Old Testament prophets. Jeremiah in chapter 25 said, thus the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. They shall drink and stagger and be crazed because of the sword which I'm sending among them." It's very similar language to the fall of Babylon here, only Babylon now is a spiritual power. "They heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Remember to her as she has herself been, or render to her as she herself has rendered, and repay her double for her deeds.'" He wants his people to come out because he's going to punish Babylon. She has before shed the blood of Christians. He's going to make her drink the blood of his wrath now. This is the punishment pronounced. The reasons for the punishment are unfolded in the next several verses, about verse 7 through verse 20. Verse 7 says, "She glorified herself and played the wanton, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, 'A queen I sit, I'm no widow. Mourning I shall never see.' So shall her plagues come in a single day. Rome, which was so sure her power was great and she'd never be brought down, is going to be brought down in a day. So suddenly she's destroyed. The kings of the earth who committed fornication with her weep and wail over her. The merchants," verse 15, "of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand afar off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Everybody who got rich off Rome stands and mourns and wails as they see Rome fall, suddenly fall." The reasons for her fall? She vaunted herself. She glorified herself. She set herself on material values. And he has a long list of those. "The merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her since nobody buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, all kinds of scented wood, all articles of ivory, all articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, and slaves," that is, the souls of men. She was rich, and everybody else was getting rich through commerce with her, and all of a sudden she's brought down. The great power that is persecuting the church will be wiped out, destroyed as suddenly as she was raised up. The result of all this? Well, in verse 19, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, O saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her." The saints are happy. The evil power has fallen. They are now free to carry on their service to God. The effects on the city itself: "The sound of trumpets and minstrels and of flute players and trumpeters shall be heard in thee no more." There's no more gaiety in Rome. "A craftsman of any craft shall be found in thee no more, and the sound of the millstone shall be heard in thee no more." No more work going on in Rome. "The light of a lamp shall shine in thee no more, and the voice of bridegroom and bride shall be heard in thee no more." There's not going to be any marriage or perpetuation of the family so that Roman power can be carried on. The destruction is final and complete. It's a different picture from the seven bowls, but nonetheless final. God is going to punish those who have persecuted his people. Now, we're saying that Revelation has no application other than in AD 96, to the point that those who are persecuting the church are going to be destroyed. I'm not saying that. I would rather draw out of it what you might call a philosophy of history, a belief that whenever in any age powers set themselves against the people of God, they may seem to overcome for a time, but God has bowls of wrath and trumpets to sound and seals to open that we do not know of. And though our power is small, his is great, and he will overcome. It's just as true today as it was then. I suspect that if John had been dividing Revelation, he would have divided it not at the end of chapter 18, but at the 10th verse of chapter 19. But we'll leave that for next week. Because in the first 10 verses of chapter 19, the bridegroom has a feast with his bride. And the people of God who've been put down in the past chapters are now enjoying a feast around the table with the Lamb himself. They're happy. The enemy has been overcome. That's the picture Revelation is getting across. It isn't a timetable of what's going to happen in the future. It is rather a principle. God is going to punish those who persecute his people. His cause is going to overcome. And in the closing chapters, those enemies, the devil, the beast, and the false prophet, will be taken and one at a time cast into hell. And the New Jerusalem will come down from God out of heaven. He will have overcome. It does have a reference to the end of the world in the sense that it tells us how the battle is all going to come out. But its primary application is hope, comfort, consolation to people who are dying under the sword of Domitian in an awful outpouring of persecution that centers on one question: is Caesar Lord or is Jesus Lord? And the Christian died because he believed Christ is Lord. We commit our lives under very different circumstances today, but there are still real trials. But there is a promise. Whatever the opposition, God will overcome. And that's the hope that you can share. Always say.